On AM 760, San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you live from La Vie with 50,000 watts of power. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, L.A. County, up the coast of Seattle, on a good night out to the desert. And now time to introduce the main man of the hour. He is a CPA extraordinaire. He's an accomplished marathon runner. He is a philanthropist. He's a family office expert to several high-net-worth families. And he is a best-selling author, and his name is Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you tonight?
I'm actually tired, you know, because I had a lot of people over for Thanksgiving, Joe, and I'm still recovering.
Well, that happens. How many years now is this, Richard?
We did our eighth annual Oceanside Turkey Trot. And we had a lot of people there. We had over 10,000 runners, over 16,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
We raised over $100,000 for local charities. One of the neat things about what we do is $5 of every runner's entry fee goes to the charity of their choice.
Mm-hmm.
And we had like the Running Hall of Fame out there. We had Steve Scott, who's run more sub-4-minute miles than any man in history. Mm-hmm. Joaquim Cruz was out there, a 1984 gold medal winner. Let's see, Dave Claus, one of the all-time great runners from North County. On the women's side, we had, who was there, Milena Gluzek, 2002 U.S. half marathon champion. McKelly Jones won the women's five-miler. McKelly was a silver medalist in the most recent Olympics.
Huh.
So it was like the Runner's Hall of Fame. I'll talk about our great runner, Lucas Last.
Mm-hmm.
Had some other celebrities out there. General Brahms, retired Marine Corps, probably the greatest judge advocate in the history of the Corps, was out, as well as Jay Bullard.
A lot of Marines get involved in this, don't they? A lot of Marines get involved.
Absolutely. A lot of my volunteers were Marines, and a lot were runners. Wanted to thank again Pacific Marine Credit Union, our major sponsor, as well as Genentech for all their help. KUSI was out there from 6 o'clock until 10, doing their weather update every 15 minutes live from the Oceanside Turkey Trot. So thanks to Leslie Lopez. Great job, Leslie, doing that. We really appreciate having you there. Also, Austin Bice Foundation brought out over 500 runners. They raised their own funds through our platform. And so we had some huge teams, but Austin Bice led the cause. It was certainly worth $40 to run it, because after I did the 5-miler at 7 o'clock for Sirius, I then donned a 9-pound turkey costume and did the 5K at 8:30 in my 9-pound turkey costume. And my bet with Lucas Versbikas, who we'll talk about last, I didn't win my bet. I told him that I would attempt to win the 5K. I would attempt to run the 5K in a 9-pound turkey costume after running 5 miles for Sirius faster than he could do the 5-miler, and I didn't quite make it. I ran the 5K on tired legs in 25:50 something, but he won. Our man Lucas won the 5-miler in 25:16.
What's so that average per mile?
That's a 5:03 mile pace for 5 miles.
Folks, 5 minutes for a mile for 5 miles.
So Lucas was cooking, and he said he was going to go for the win, and he got it. And so great story. It's his first competitive major win since recovering, of course, from his broken back in the summer of 12. And he's certainly well on the way to recovery and on the path to qualifying for the 2016 Olympics, whether that's as a triathlete or maybe in the 5K or 10K remains to be seen.
And training right here in Chula Vista.
Down at the Olympic Training Center.
Correct.
So it was really, really cool that Lucas could pull that off, and had some folks watch him come down the stretch and said, it's just amazing to see. He actually trailed last year's defending champion for the first 7 kilometers of about the 8-kilometer run, 5 miles,
and then
just took the gentleman out with a kilometer to go.
And then your Move Your Feet Before You Eat Foundation, tell people where that money goes to.
Move Your Feet Before You Eat Foundation is basically a conduit charity, so we don't really raise funds for ourselves. As I mentioned, $5 of every runner's entry fee goes to the charity of the runner's choice. We have about 400 charities and schools on our platform centered in Oceanside and Vista. Our net profit goes to the Oceanside Boys and Girls Club to run their after-school running and fitness programs, and then many of the charities that are on our platform, they'll bring out running teams, but in addition to the $5 of every runner's entry fee that they raise, they'll do their own fundraisers, whether that's, you know, bake sales at schools or silent auctions. We never touch that money either. That just goes to the charity that works off of our platform. So we estimate that with all of those beneficiaries, it was over $100,000 raised for local charities.
Yeah.
Which is really, really cool stuff.
And then, but the Move Your Feet Before You Eat Foundation goes to this, specifically tell them what that's all about.
Move Your Feet Before You Eat Foundation basically just encourages everyday physical activity and healthy eating as part of your daily routine. And so it's more of a lifestyle.
And, and you're helping out the student population, too,
it's
right?
Primarily geared towards the Oceanside City School student population. Before and after school running and fitness programs, we've improved fitness scores in Oceanside. We've helped to improve API, Academic Performance Index scores in Oceanside. Mm-hmm. We've contributed to reducing teen pregnancy in Oceanside from its all-time high because many of our after-school running programs are geared towards the high school teen female population. There, of course, has been a multi-generational history of teen pregnancy in Oceanside. So we've contributed to that as well. And we couldn't have pulled this off with we had about 500 volunteers. My team is incredible. And we couldn't do it without our amazing, amazing volunteers who come out and pitch in on Thanksgiving morning.
It's a good idea. But you can't, if you're running, you can't get pregnant, I guess. So maybe that.
No, but I have. Although I'll tell you, when I was running the Las Vegas Marathon once upon a time, I passed about seven or eight couples who were getting married while running.
Really?
I was looking for the whole way for a couple that was getting divorced while running but couldn't find one. But that comes later.
And of course, a lot of pregnant women who are pregnant run, and you see a lot of couples pushing their kids in the runs.
Yeah,
too,
we had right? tons of strollers out.
Tell me about the little kids running in this. So you have a lot of that because that's
So we had the 5 miler, which is more of the serious race. As I said, we had some heavy duty runners out for that, and then mm-hmm. we have what we call the people's race, which is the 5K, 3.1 miles at 8:30, and then after that we have the kids 1 miler. Oh, great story on the kids 1 miler. The young boy who's 12 who ran like a 5:06 mile to win. He had a pacer. Who peeled off with about 50 yards to go, pacing him the whole way. So,
I thought you were talking about a car with those big windows.
He had a high school runner pacing him, so he's obviously very serious.
Wow, very cool.
And then we finish up with the little kids' quarter miler, the 2, 3, and 4-year-olds, which is absolutely hilarious because we have a finish line tape, right? I'm dressed as a turkey at that point. Uh-huh. So a lot of these little, the wee people, as I call them, they're 3 and 4 years old, they'll show up at the finish line tape and they'll just stop. They won't break because they don't know what to do. Or they'll go around. Behind me or around the gentleman David Kane, who's holding the tape on the other side.
And then how long is that? That's just a short block.
That's a quarter mile.
Quarter mile, okay.
That's 440 yards for those of you who are math challenged.
Wonderful.
But that's hilarious to see.
So. Well, we've got a really important guest. I don't want to take any more of his time, but congratulations on that.
Thank
great
you.
Achievement.
But enough about my charity.
Yeah, man. I tell you what, for the sake of continuity, why don't we take our first break right now, and then we'll come back with our VIP guest right after this. So hang on, we'll be right back. All right, we're back with more of It's Your Money in Your Life. Live from La Vie, and time to get into our show with our very important guest. He came to town here and established his office in 1978. He's a full-service architecture and planning firm with offices here in Palo Alto. He's done projects, civic, academic, cultural, residential, you name it, all kinds of awards. Most recently, honored our city with his creation of our San Diego Public Library, and we'll get into his whole history and everything else, but you know him as Rob Wellington Quigley. Rob, good evening, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
It is a real thrill to have you here, and I guess with most of our guests, we always like to find out, where they were born and what inspired them to get into their field, et cetera, et cetera. So I know you went to the University of Utah, was it? Mm-hmm. But maybe give us a little born and raised info we'll go from there.
I grew up in the beach areas of Los Angeles.
Really?
Okay. And decided to go to University of Utah to college, mm-hmm. partly because the campus is 20 minutes from Alta.
Huh.
And I was a skier.
Ah, so okay.
That worked out great.
Which beach is in L.A., by the way?
Manhattan Beach and Hermosa Beach. Okay. And graduated from Palos Verdes.
Okay. All right. So get off into skiing, go up to Utah and for college and... But what inspired you to get into architecture?
Well, my father was a civil engineer, and he was always involved with architects and architecture, of course. And I used to work in his office on summers. Mm-hmm. And, doing sewer inverts and mm-hmm. piping and things like that and grades wasn't as interesting as what I saw the architects doing.
Mm-hmm.
So at one point late in high school, I went to my father and I said, Dad, I've decided that I'm going to study architecture.
Hmm.
And he said, son, why would you want to do that? He said, engineers are people that take very difficult problems and simplify them for the good of society.
Uh-huh.
Architects are people that take very simple problems and complicate them. Why would you want to spend your life doing that?
So, sounds like there might be more money. Than
of course, you look at a lot of your structures, and there's a simple beauty and elegance and a complexity all wrapped into one when I see a lot of your stuff.
Yeah, so. I think, of course, he was dead wrong.
Yeah. Well, it's like Irwin Jacobs, his high school, he wanted to go into engineering, and his high school counselor said, forget about it. There's no future in it. So, you know, you can't listen to everybody.
Yeah. Well, and even in college, I had my problems. I mean, I worked hard. I was a hard worker. I wasn't a partier in college. And I got F's and D's in design.
And
about halfway through, I went to the dean and I just said, you know, I don't think I'm cut out for this. I guess it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And he came back and he said, well, sometimes we have late bloomers. Why don't you just stick with it a little while longer? Of course, that was before I understood the economics of colleges, so I believed him.
Was Utah known for an architecture program? Or
they weren't really. They actually had a good program. It was very small. Mm-hmm. Our graduating class was 15 people.
Oh, my gosh.
Which was the largest they had ever graduated.
This had to be one of 60.
But it had an intimacy and a relationship with your professors that was very, very special. And I think I was lucky, actually, to go there.
Of course, it was all pre-computer and everything, right?
Oh, absolutely. We actually drew with our pencils and hands. Very tactile.
We use paper?
We use paper. A lot less paper than we do now, by the way, in computer age.
You know, he does resemble Dr. Seuss a little bit, Richard. Have you ever seen pictures of him?
Yeah,
I know. Did you ever meet Dr. Seuss,
I've met his wife, but I never actually met Dr. Seuss.
You do kind of resemble him in a way. So
His wife, by the way, made a wonderful contribution to the library and the children's area is Dr. Seuss themed.
Oh, yeah. That's the first thing I saw. Well, Richard, have you been down there yet or had a chance to?
I haven't been down there with enough time in my schedule to actually spend time. So I'm going back. I want to check out the eighth floor, too, baseball collection.
I went down there. I got previews and everything. And then, of course, when you get to the Dr. Seuss area, huge murals of the Dr. Seuss characters and the books and some collectibles that Audrey Geisel's donated in glass cases, of course, or Lucite, whatever it is. But just phenomenal. You walk in that place, you don't feel like you're in San Diego anymore. I mean, it's the first thing that hit me. I go, I can't believe this is San Diego. I felt like I was in New York or San Francisco or someplace else. And I think that's what strikes everybody, I think, when they first walk into that building. So getting back to Utah after college, did you start working in another architectural firm or?
No, that was during the Vietnam War years. Mm. And while I wasn't very political in those years, it was clear to me that the Vietnam War was not a proper use of anyone's time or money. And I certainly wasn't going to go kill people over there for some corporation.
You and Muhammad Ali, right?
So, but I did think I owed my country something. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't think it was a free ride. Mm-hmm. So I joined the Peace Corps instead.
Mm. I did read that. So then that's when it first started back there. Sergeant Shriver, I guess, began it.
We were kind of the second generation. Mm-hmm. And I went to Chile. I got an invitation to go to Chile and worked with the self-help housing program down there. So what wonderful two-year experience.
Peace Corps is not easy to get into. It takes about a year. They do a background check.
No, I actually had a fairly high security clearance grade. It was strange. They wanted to make sure I wouldn't embarrass anyone, so they checked they check your backgrounds. They even talked to my first grade teacher.
Isn't that something, Richard? Do you know anybody who's been in the Peace Corps and gone through that?
Yeah, I do. Can the first grade teacher even remember after all those years?
I don't know.
I don't know. I have to think there's got to be some connection with the intelligence community, but I'm just guessing. But who the heck knows? So you're down in Chile, and then what happens? I mean, you get more involved with the buildings and the structures, or
yes. What? Oh, it was a fascinating time to be there. I was assigned to a group. You're actually working with the Chilean government, not for the U.S. government, even though they send us a little check to buy food.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a total immersion in a different culture. Mm-hmm. It's essentially changed the way I related to everything. It's really a wonderful experience.
And so then the graduation into the architectural profession.
Yeah, so from an architectural standpoint, it was almost like a cleansing. You know, I'd been focused on architecture completely, like, you know, even to the point of sort of having blinders in because you have to be able to succeed and graduate. And this just kind of opened up a much broader worldview for me, so that when I returned after 2 years living on the edge of the Atacama Desert there in some in relative isolation, I was very focused on what I wanted to do with architecture. And I was clear that architecture ought to be local. It ought to reflect regional and local concerns. It shouldn't be this kind of universal thing where your building could actually be placed in any city, which was very popular. That was kind of the ethic of the time. In fact, it still is.
It is,
So you're saying it should be a source of community pride?
And absolutely, but it also, a building that is more universal, more strict modernist, can be a source of pride, but it's not your pride. It's the pride of owning something that may or may not fit within your culture.
And then
how
did you discover San Diego that you wanted to be based here?
Well, I was also a surfer, and so that meant I was happy to live anywhere between Santa Barbara and the Mexican border. And I have to tell you, after 2 years living in a small village, I got off the plane at LAX, and the culture shock, as you can imagine, moving to the small village was one thing, but nothing like the culture shock returning to the United States.
Of course, they probably had some smog back
then. It took me about 2 minutes to decide I was never going to live in Los Angeles. I couldn't breathe. I mean, it was horrible.
So, of course, the air is better now, but then how did you stumble upon San Diego?
It was a city that at that point in time was unsure of what it wanted to be. And so this was in the 70s. Downtown was a wasteland. I mean, there was nothing downtown. Everybody had moved to the suburbs or to Mission Valley.
I remember.
There was no shopping. There were porno shops and tattoo parlors. And that was about the extent.
You parked your car down there, you'd leave your glove compartment open so nobody would break into it and leave it empty.
Well, we opened our first studio down there at State and G. And we would have wild parties in the evenings. The police would come to our parties because they were bored. There was no crime down there because there was no people down there.
Oh, my gosh.
It was just literally a wasteland.
Well, that sure changed a lot.
And I thought, well, if I stay in Los Angeles, where my whole family was, my opportunities are limited. L.A. is going to be what it wants to be, whether I'm there or not.
We're more of a blank slate down there.
San Diego was a blank slate in those years, especially the urban side of it was a blank slate. And it was a chance to hopefully to contribute.
Yeah. Wow. So what was your first project in San Diego?
I started off doing residences, like most young architects. I started, by the way, way too soon. I worked only 7 months in a legitimate architectural office and then went out on my own. I had three projects to do, and I went out on my own to do them. And just thinking that was really the best way to learn, I didn't realize the best way to learn is actually to be in an architectural office making your mistakes on someone else's dime. And so I had to pay for my mistakes and my learning curve. But it was a wonderful time. So I started off doing just residential projects. There were about five or eight of us in the office. And it was always a collective. Like my name's on the door, but all these projects are done by... never by me alone, always by these wonderful
talents.
Those
first three residences, are they still around today, and where are they located? Who is
what part of town? They are. One is in Laguna Beach, and two of them are in Del Mar. The one in Laguna Beach, interestingly enough, was for an old friend of the family's, and it was my first house. When you can imagine, it was not, in retrospect, it was not the best house. But it was willed upon the death of the parents to the son. The son is somebody I grew up with, and he called me one day and said, "Rob, I don't know how you're going to take this, but I'd like to rip your house down and build a new house. Would you be interested?" And I said, "Fantastic! A cleansing, a shower. Yeah. I can erase all those old mistakes.
It's called a mulligan.
Born again.
Isn't that great, though? You get a second opportunity,
second chance.
Yeah,
second chance. And so we had a great time building this house, and it was finished about 2 years ago.
Oh my gosh! We have to I got to look on the website see if it's there. But anyway, we got to take our break and come right back after with thanks, sponsors. Hang on, we'll be right back with more of It's Your Money in Your Life live from La Vie. All right, we're back with the second half of It's Your Money and Your Life, and over to Richard to thank our sponsors.
Thank you, sponsors. Couldn't do it without you. They include, in fact, this is the entire list, lovely La Valencia Hotel in La Jolla, the La Vie. Going to get Cafe La Rue open here one of these days very, very soon as we approach the holidays. So thanks to Mark DiBella, Tammy Wong, and the crew at lovely La Vie. UBS with Mr. Michael Caronta and Drew Freitas. Thank you very much, UBS. Jason Kruger, Signature Analytics, the best CFO firm here in San Diego. Our newest sponsor, Brenda Geiger with Geiger Law Offices. She was just on the show recently. Hit our website and check out our great podcast. Our favorite CPAs on the planet, gearing up for next tax season already, I would imagine. Polito Epic CPAs up in Vista, Don Epic and Paul Polito. Thank you. Joel Gruskin, Cost Segregation Initiatives, helping real estate owners improve their real estate cash flow. San Diego, probably the West Coast, maybe the United States, best business valuation expert, Mr. Carl Sheeler, now with Berkeley Research Group, helping business owners improve the value of their businesses. And last, but certainly not least, right across the street from lovely La Vie, Regions Bank, Mr. Steve Sefton, Mr. Sean Puckett. Thank you all, sponsors. Joe, how can our listeners find out more about network of sponsors?
They just have to get over to iymoney.com, click on sponsors. All their personal information is there, their contact information. And I know, Richard, you've been working with all of them for many years with successful results, correct?
All for many years, with the exception of Brenda Geiger, who's still fairly young. So I don't want to prejudice anybody about a woman's age. But I've known her for about 10 years.
Well,
everybody else at least 20.
Well, contact Brenda.
She's incredible.
You can get free books from her.
Some great books.
Yeah, so outstanding. But back to our prestigious guest tonight, Rob Wellington Quigley, noted architect in San Diego and beyond. How many states are your projects in, Rob? Are they mostly California? Or
I try hard to stay local because I don't really enjoy the long-distance travel.
Right.
So we have an office in Palo Alto and San Diego, and about... Actually, it's pretty well split half and half between those two locations.
Yeah,
we do work out of state occasionally.
And then, how many structures would you say in San Diego alone that you've worked on or had a hand in? It must be several dozen, right?
That's a good question. Yeah. Oh, more than that.
Really? Yeah.
You know, I haven't counted.
Really?
you do a lot of work up in San Jose, though, because I know my sister and brother and I live up there, and you've done a couple of, I think it's joint use community centers, libraries that I've seen your name associated
with.
Right?
San Jose has a very interesting program where they combine their community centers with their libraries in a single building, which creates a lot of energy synergy.
I think it's good for kids, good for young people.
Yeah, yeah, wonderful. They have areas for young kids and seniors, and they bring them all together in this single building.
Yeah.
We just finished two of those up there.
Two of them, okay.
But folks, when you're driving around San Diego, this, like, for instance, the Solana Beach train station, cool place. Anything you see that's probably a really cool structure, probably Rob Quigley or his staff has had a hand in it. Would you say that's...
Well, I would say it's absolutely true.
Thanks for teeing that one up, yeah, but anyway...
Well, now this, the San Diego City, the new library, the use of air and space, I see, is very important for you. I mean, open space, open doors, is that, and sustainability is a big thing of yours, right?
Well, both of those issues are big. Mm-hmm. Choreography is something that's intrinsic in our architecture, our design process.
Mm-hmm.
When I was up in Utah studying architecture, the strongest school they had there was not the architecture department or business or anything else. It was dance.
Mm-hmm.
They actually had the best dance department in the United States.
Huh.
And as architects, we collaborated with the dancers, worked with them, and I learned a lot from them. I learned a lot about choreography. And that actually, dance and architecture are very similar. What changes is your point of reference.
Huh.
You know, if you think about it, a dance, you're looking at space. You're looking at space form and deform and change and move, and you're looking at crescendos and buildups and hierarchy and all that, but you're stationary. You're sitting in a seat in the audience.
Yeah.
Architecture, it's the same thing, but your vantage point changes. The architecture is static, and you're moving. You're moving through. You're the choreography.
That's neat.
How about
But the
that?
Rules are the same, actually. I actually choreographed a ballet once.
Really?
It's a total failure, but it was a noble attempt. but the rules are the same. So if you go, for instance, to the Children's Museum...
So you're saying the structure of the dancers on the stage kind of gives you vision in terms of the...
You're moving through that building. It's people seeing people. It's kids seeing parents. It's staff seeing patrons. And the stairways are always brought out into the open. Mm. You never go into a closet or a walled room to go up or down. You're always moving kinetically and choreographically. And the main library is the same way.
Have you done it? Did you name your ballet the FAIA ballet? I'm just kidding.
I called it locomotion.
Okay.
Have you done any airports or anything like that?
I haven't done anything. The library is the largest building I've ever done, and probably ever will do.
But Rob, you mentioned the term sustainable architecture. Can you tell our listeners what that actually means? Because I don't think a lot of listeners have even heard that term before.
Let me start with a little bit of history. So the third house I did was for Andy and Flossie Cohen in Del Mar, and this happened to be during that first energy crisis. Mm-hmm. Remember that in the 70s, where people were lined up at a gas station.
Yeah, right. I remember that well.
And there was some inkling.
I wrote about that in my latest book.
Inkling in the consciousness that maybe America
Earth Day
didn't
started.
Have the right to infinite resources.
Earth Day came out of that experience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Earth Day came out of that. And I had an awakening. I found that I was grossly undereducated on issues of sustainability. Architecture schools were not involved in that at all. And I in the office actually went into hibernation and re-educated ourselves. And we created one of the first solar houses in San Diego. And more importantly, learned about passive energy. Passive energy is making the architecture itself respond to the climate.
Mm-hmm.
And our best probably civic example of that is, again, the Children's Museum.
Sure.
There is actually no mechanical heating and cooling system in the galleries.
Why
nothing.
Didn't know that? Wow.
Nothing but a fan.
Right.
And it actually heats and cools itself naturally with the way the sun moves and the way the air currents move.
Huh. How about that?
In my mind, there is nothing more important than sustainability in our
culture.
Well, that's
important. And of course, buildings, it's about they consume about 50% of our energy, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Across the country. So we've got to get better at that. And of course, you're in a great part of the country where we've got a climate where you can do a lot of
things. Well, that's the thing. People say, well, maybe it's not so important in a benign climate like San Diego. Mm-hmm. But the reality is it's even more important because it's so relatively easy to achieve tremendous savings.
Yeah. Hey, the library up top there, you've got this one walkway that's gated that goes out to nowhere, this platform. What was the I've been on there. I took a picture of my reflection in the window.
Yes.
What was the thought of behind that?
I would guess, as you've just insinuated, that it's the most photographed spot in San Diego at the moment. I don't know anyone who's been up there who didn't have their photograph taken at that spot. So we suspected that might happen, but it's really architecture is not just about solving mechanical and circulation function. It's about emotional function as well.
Uh-huh.
Now, engineers don't like to acknowledge that. Accountants don't like to acknowledge that. Sometimes even council people don't like to acknowledge that. But it's critical to the success of a piece of architecture. And so there are several things about the building that are all about the mind, that are about enticing you to engage with the architecture before you enter the building.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm trying to get people who are walking down up the street to say, wait a minute, I got to go inside there. I've got to encounter this building. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, they are seduced, of course, by all the amenities of the library.
And of course, the Joan and Irwin Jacobs, the part of the building that their name is on, it kind of looks like the front of a ship.
Yeah, it does.
And that's probably keeping with the maritime structure of the whole, all the harbor structures.
That's part of the references, yeah. But the idea of the perch that you described and the idea of the stair to somewhere, which is this kind of magical stair that hangs off the side of the building that has no doors to it.
Yeah.
Or from it.
Yeah.
It's all about engaging the mind so that you kind of want to explore the building.
Yeah. But we got to take a break. We'll engage your mind a little bit more when we come back after this break. Hang on. All right. We're back in the home stretch with It's Your Money and Your Life, live from La Vie with our very important guest, Rob Quigley, probably the most notable architect in San Diego and many people around the country know who he is. Regarding I had a question about the library, but Richard, why don't you ask a question? I've been talking quite a bit.
I wanted to ask a question about the library. It's such a huge, huge place. Do you have a favorite spot there, or favorite room, favorite something?
Oh, boy.
Or not really?
Not really. There's a whole number of little places. To me, the library is about discovery.
Yeah.
And what I enjoy is people that come back and tell me, you know, I was walking through here on the fifth floor, mm-hmm. and and discovered this little alcove that hangs out over the street. I had a view all the way up to the gas lamp. Yeah. That surprised me. To me, that's
you know, Rob,
I'm
very honored that you said that because I bought a brick in the patio, and and it says "Read and Discover" and my name, of course. But and the bricks are great, and folks, you can still buy one. I think it's supportmylibrary.org or something, but you can still buy a brick in down there. But I think 3,000 folks have bricks inside and out. And it's just cool. Some of them are really funny. One just says "shh" with about seven.
Did you see the one that was a proposal?
I didn't.
Yeah, one says, "Will you marry me?"
Oh, really?
And the guy actually brought his fiance to the brick and proposed to him.
Oh my gosh!
At that spot.
Oh my gosh! Oh really?
Thank goodness she said yes. Yeah. And we've already had one wedding in the library.
Is that right? And of course, if he was late, it's a nickel a day, right? But what kind of future projects do you have in the pipeline, Rob? Anything you can talk about? Or,
oh, sure. We've got a number of good projects. Our office, like all architectural offices right now, are not as busy as we'd like to be. We're still coming out of this horrible recession.
Yeah.
But we're working, for instance, for a nonprofit called Ocean Discovery Institute. Mm. This is this amazing, amazing program.
Up in UCSD,
that
right?
was invented here. No, not at UCSD. No? It's a private nonprofit.
Oh.
They now have offices in a trailer park along Mission Bay. And this will be their first legitimate facility. It'll be up in University Heights. But it's a program that looks at high school kids and younger, and introduces them to the ocean sciences.
Wow!
And these are kids that had no idea what science was about.
Do they collaborate with Scripps at all or not?
And I think they do off and on. I'm not sure, but they their success rate is just phenomenal.
Yeah, the ocean.
Eight out of ten kids from University Heights go to college after they get involved in this program.
Really?
So it's a real honor to be able to work with a group like that.
And the structure, and where is that structure going to be built? Do they have a property?
They have a site. It's right next to Florence Joyner High School there, up on Thorn Avenue.
Yeah, Thorn Avenue. Okay.
Yeah,
sure.
Right, you know where that is.
Yep.
Interesting.
And it's right at the head of a canyon. And part of the program is actually for the building to engage the canyon, and for the students, will become custodians of the canyon. They'll help to revitalize it, to bring it back to its natural state.
Huh.
So, Rob, you're sort of talking about collaboration. I know that's very important in your business. Can you describe how you use collaboration and collaborate with others to pull off these amazing things that you build and create?
You know, the media likes to think as architects and likes to characterize architects as, you know, as sole practitioners.
Yeah, you're like the lone wolf who's
like the lone
wolf
that, you know, like the library, for instance, jumped into my head in the middle of the night and woke up and we built it. You know, that's not how it works. Architects, you might think of them more like movie directors, where essentially we're surrounded by people much more talented and smarter than we are. And our role is really to kind of choreograph or direct all these incredible talents to create this whole. Over 100 people worked on this building.
Wow.
And deserve every bit of as much credit as I do.
But as far as the look and the structure, I mean, that did, you were the general.
Yeah, I directed the basic idea, the look and the structure.
Yeah.
But for instance, the chandeliers were designed by Brian Harris, who's now in Utah.
Yeah.
We collaborated on that, but it's really his design. The building wouldn't exist without the phenomenal effort of Art Castro and Tucker Sadler.
Yeah.
He handled the management side of it, which, if you can imagine,
but
is incredibly complex.
Their early sketches are from 17 years ago, right? I mean, pretty much.
Well, we were hired 17 years ago to do this. I was a young man.
We all had more hair back
Smooth skin, lots of hair. And the city, in its wisdom, hired a young architect to do this. And I saw the other day that my first little napkin sketch, little hand sketch of the library that looks almost exactly like what was built, was dated 2004.
Oh, my gosh.
So almost 10 years.
That was the final version. We designed this building for four different sites as the politics and the mayors and the council people changed over the years.
So where are all those early artifacts, the sketches? Are they in your office? Or
we have everything.
You do? They need to be on display. Need to be on display somewhere. I think there should be a little tribute area.
I think there may be an exhibit.
That'd be cool. So, Anyway, Richard, any closing ideas
Rob,
or questions?
Rob, you won a coveted Maybach Award, I think, what, about 7-8 years ago. Can you tell our listeners what that is? Because that's a really big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal in the world of architecture, and we're very proud of it. The Maybach Award is sort of like the gold medal for the state of California, and the two most intensive states architecturally are New York and California. Mm-hmm. And it's an award not for a single building or not for a single work, but for a body of work. And as you said, for the collaboration mm-hmm. that went into that body of work.
Yeah, mm. Neat stuff.
Yeah. So, and let's see. So you've got the Ocean Discovery Institute and anything else that of note that you'd like to talk about?
Well, there's a couple of interesting projects. We're just working on a small mixed-use building across the street from the Solana Station.
Mm, very cool.
And I really enjoy these mixed-use projects, even the small ones, because the chance to kind of put together the synergy between residential and commercial and mm-hmm. retail.
Folks, get on Rob's website and check out some great pictures and everything else, photographs, robquigley.com. If you're down near the ballpark or library, his office is 13th and J, take a walk by there and check it out. Very, very, very cool structure. So how much time do we have left, Justin? We got a couple minutes left to go. So, Rob, what else can we talk about here? Any closing thoughts?
Rob, I want to ask young people who are coming into architecture. I know the business has changed dramatically since you came into about 40 years ago. What advice would you have for a young person who's thinking about majoring this, studying this, coming into this as a profession?
I'd say surf and go to Chile myself.
Yeah. Ski and surf and go to Chile.
That's right. Right. Keep your head clear and your the proper perspective.
Yeah. But once you're done having all that fun.
You know, I mean, Joe's actually right. I would advise after architecture school that you somehow take a sabbatical, a break. The Peace Corps was wonderful, but there's other ways to do it. Mm-hmm. And if possible, leave our culture.
NGOs, right?
Immerse yourself in some other kind of a culture, then come back to architecture. I just think you're more clear-headed. And you'll do better work that way.
That's the advice. I think a lot of young people just go to college to get the right job, right career, and they come out. Yeah. And of course, the economy's changed so dramatically that you don't necessarily have that kind of security that you used to have with employment opportunities.
Yeah. Let me ask you one other question with regard to sustainability. The library, did you use much recycled or reused material in there? Or?
We did. We tried, whenever possible, to use local materials. Mm-hmm.
But, Rob, unfortunately, we are out of time. It was such a pleasure to have you here.
Rob, thanks so much.
Thank
that
you very
great.
Much. Get over to robquigley.com. He's the greatest architect in San Diego and probably one of the best in the country. And we'd like to thank Justin Hart, our sound engineer, for making his sound great. Thanks to Craig Blanke, account executive, and thanks to Dave Smith, programming genius here at KFMB. You have a good week, everybody. We'll see you next week. Take care now.